This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with SharePad from ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.
Hello and welcome to the Twin Peaks Investing Podcast. This is podcast number 130. And for those of you that are watching us on YouTube, you can see we've got a guest with us. We've got a fantastic guest for you, ladies and gents, today on this very warm Tuesday evening. We're recording early. And we've got Martin Flitton at Private Punter on Twitter/X. And of course, I've got my co-host with me, Henry Viola here at HT Viola. And I am, of course, Peter Higgins. You can find me on Twitter/X at Conquest3. So we're going to hit straight into here now with the markets. We're going to go briefly to the markets. I'm going to get into speaking with our brilliant guest, Martin. He's going to tell us a little bit about himself, about his investing strategy, possibly a few stocks. Henry's going to tell us about a few stocks. Then I'm going to go completely off kilter and tell you about all the stocks. Okay. Today, we had the FTSE 100 opened up really, really well on Tuesday, the 25th of June, and then it gave it all up. At an intraday high of 8,294, intraday low of 8,245, and it finished at 8,247, down 37 points. FTSE All Share was down, similar sort of percentage, of 0.48%, down 21 points at 4,493, still comfortably above that 4,000 sort of support level. And the FTSE AIM All Share remains below 800, which it touched on when it was, you know, doing really well earlier on in the year at 768, was down 0.5% today. Right, so that's all I'm going to say about the markets. Obviously, the US markets are doing their own thing, being carried or were being carried by the likes of Nvidia up until a few days ago. And the last 3 days, it's given up a bit of its momentum after its split. And bizarrely, I think it was yesterday, the markets were struggling earlier on because Nvidia was down again. But all the other stocks, or lots of other stocks in the US, did well, and the US markets were up for the first time without Nvidia carrying it, which is nice. We might see some rebalancing of some of the stocks up there because it's being carried by five stocks, most of the US markets at the present time. We're going to talk about tech. We're going to talk about MEX. And we're going to talk about Cambridge. So I'm going to hand over, straight over to Martin Flitton, our guest, to introduce himself to us. You already know all about Henry. Henry's just, doing Henry. You know, he's always busy in himself, looking after all things Gallagher and winning tenders worth millions and billions. So we're going to go straight into Martin here. Martin, welcome to the pod, guy. Thank you ever so much for joining myself and Henry on this mad thing we call the Twin Peaks Investing Podcast. Thank you ever so much for being brave enough to come on here. And just tell everybody about yourself, mate. Where did it all start for you, investing-wise, what you do, what your style is, a couple of stocks?
Yeah.
Over to you, fella.
Okay. Well, first of all, Pete, I'll say this is totally out of my comfort zone. I'm used to being stuck behind a screen, but doing this just is a bit surreal. So you have to bear with me. So for me, I'd always had an interest in stocks, but really only had a dabble back in the early 90s. And at that point, we renovated the home that we're still in today, had a bit of money left over, and I invested in two stocks that were basically close to what I do, which were Ibstock and Marley, the old roof tile company. And they both subsequently did very well. Ibstock was taken over, subsequently has now come back to the market. But that sort of, piqued my interest. So it sort of went from there. I then got involved in a share club, And we were, pretty successful. It was all the rage. I'm going back to about sort of 1999, that sort of time, 2000. And the Cambridge Evening News wanted to interview us. And the other guys elected me as the spokesman.
Excellent.
So I did the interview, got on well with the editor. And a couple of weeks later, she came back and asked me if I'd be interested in penning a one-off piece on something that I was looking at, which I did. And that seemed to have gone down really well. So they then came back and said, "Would you do a monthly piece? And we'll pay you some money for it," which was nice. And that then evolved into a weekly slot. So
As
that,
it does, as it often does, when you do a good job.
and that ran for, oh gosh, probably 20 years.
Wow, brilliant.
And it finished basically because the Cambridge News was taken over by Reach. It
I
was,
knew you were going to say reach.
yeah, well, it was
Overreach.
actually,
Call it overreach.
yeah, absolutely. It was somebody else before that, but then Reach subsequently acquired it. So most of the journalists, that I knew, and certainly the edit business editor, they all went. And at that time, I was still doing some stuff for them. And it was no longer in print. It was all uploaded to their website. And I wrote a piece about SDI, which I've followed for many years. And I think it had something like 4,000 views on the day because it was becoming very popular. But somebody from Reach got in touch and said, "We'd really like to, sort of either change what you're doing, or we'll have to drop it because the traffic isn't heavy enough."
Wow.
So at that point, I was already sort of running my own blog in conjunction with that, running a side, and I decided, well, thanks, but no thanks, because I do what I do, and my area is predominantly small and micro cap, although I do invest in investment trusts and some of the bigger stuff, but it's predominantly smaller stuff. So that's where I am at the moment. I'm sort of I do regular interviews with companies, even mid 250 companies. I do some calls with, and sitting. Sort of labor of luck, pen it up, and it goes on the blog, and hopefully it's of interest to others,
It's a massive interest to others, mate. The stuff that you've written over the years, and that we've spoken many years ago, I think, when we first met, was because of one of those articles. And I was, as you do, you're doing a search, you're thinking, okay, let me just check out that article. And it's like some random bloke called Martin Flint. And I'm thinking, okay, let me just have a look at it anyway. It's probably going to be crap. And then I go and read it. I'm like, ooh, yes, well written, very, very insightful. You've got your own little way of writing. I think there's a really relaxed way that you write it, Martin, in the sense of always with an air of I'm an investor and I'm writing it from an investor's perspective, not a professional analyst perspective. Yeah. So I think that appeals to the broader reader as well, especially the small cap, space. And because you're in Cambridge as well, a lot of the stuff you're writing about earlier on was about tech and life sciences sort of companies, which I was drawn to. So yeah, it's always been good quality, mate. So kudos
Cheers
for
for
you, and
that.
especially running it for 20 years as well. That's fantastic.
I mean, I think it's interesting what you picked up there because I think it's very easy to just, I mean, obviously the financials are the key thing, it's what makes everything tick. But for me, I think it's very important to try and get into understanding what the business is doing and what it's about. Hence, if I go back to all those years ago when I bought Ibstock, I had an understanding of what bricks were about, and it might sound like a very simplistic thing, but it's something tangible that you can hold and touch. I think that's very important, and to try and convey that to people that are reading your stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, you touched on the fact that you knew what bricks were, but you haven't said what you were doing in the sense of what your career and your trades were. So you might want to just expand on that and say, look, what were you doing? Because it
Yeah,
looked you were
sure.
working with tradesmen and tradeswomen all the while, you know?
So I was a painter and decorator. So I served my apprenticeship, finished that, and decided to go, self-employed, start my own business. So that's what I did. And subsequently employed subcontractors, did a lot of college work. But as I got more and more interested in the share stuff and the writing, I decided that employing people, and it was a bit of a nightmare, if you any inkling of what it's like in the building trade to sort of employ subcontractors on a sort of ad hoc basis. So you might have somebody for a month, and then you don't need them for another couple of months. So you work it together, but the issue was that the Inland Revenue perceived that you're employing them constantly, and you're forever getting letters asking for return on this and return on that. So what I did when I was in my sort of late 40s, I had the offer of going to one of the colleges 3 days a week, which I did a lot of contract work for, and that worked great for me because, it's very important for me. It's important to have that contact with what I've always grown up with, and the connection with the people, and also to work in an environment of fantastic buildings, and you've got some really bright young people around you as well. You've got that, and on the other hand, I was then going home, and on the days off, that I was doing the interviews and the writing and going out and about. So it worked really well for me.
Brilliant, brilliant. Henry, first thoughts on the first opening bits there. You look a little bit gobsmacked, mate.
No, I'm really, really impressed with that, Martin. I mean, what a fantastic career. I've got a lot of respect for the self-starting on the writing side. I've got my own blog, and I've read some of your stuff. I've been away and gone and had a look at it, and I can tell how much you love it. And I love the way you describe your approach to investing what you understand and looking at what the business is actually doing, because I'm exactly the same. You know, the numbers are important, but you've really got to get a feel for the fact that there's a real business here with people doing things. And it comes through in your writing so much that you are trying to understand what these businesses are doing and how they're operating. So love that.
No, cheers. And as you say, it is very important.
I think for me, the other thing that really jumps out is the background in the construction trade. I mean, I'm not a builder myself, but I've worked in and around construction for a long time. My father-in-law was a carpenter, and it's a really interesting industry. You know, a lot going for it. And I love the fact that one of the first companies you invested in was Ibstock, and one of the first companies you covered was Ibstock, because what a great company, great story. And it's one that you don't hear talked about a lot, and I think wrongly.
No, absolutely. If I could just come in there, I mean, when I actually made that investment in Ibstock, so Ibstock was the first, and Marley followed quickly after. And the sort of final thing that sort of prompted me to invest was we were waiting for a final delivery of bricks from Ibstock. And we'd actually got a really good price about 6 months before, put the order in, we'd shopped around, and we got the bricks for, I think it was about £128 a thousand. Because you've got to remember at that time, this was about 93, we were coming out of a really bad recession. And the construction industry is always the first to go in and obviously the last to come out. And we were waiting for this delivery, and it turned up on a Saturday morning. The guy actually turned up at something like 7:30 in the morning. And I was amazed. I went out and made him a cup of tea and had a chat. And I asked him, is this normal, a Saturday? And he said, no. He said, we're just so busy. Suddenly it's just all taken over, taken off. And he was telling me that they'd had a lot of stock that they'd been sitting on, and they'd been unwinding that, obviously. But suddenly, everything had taken off in one go, and they were having to work every Saturday for the next 4 or 5 weeks. So I just thought, Ibstock at that time, the shares were about 28 pence, and I thought, if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. So, and that was just, it's a long-winded way of sort of getting back to your point, how important it is to have that sort of info.
Spot on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the beauty of it is as well when you hear it from somebody that's actually working either in the company or around the company or around the industry telling you that, the trough is over and now we're actually accelerating growth and we're actually doing really, really well. It's really, really good to have that sort of insight because you can either wait 6 months to see it on the trading update and go and then see the price just take off. And wait for that sort of thing, or you can hear it straight away from somebody who's actually working and doing it. It's really, really good to utilize that sometimes. So Martin, tell us a bit more then. 1993, you're buying Ibstock shares at 28 pence, right? So the boss, I'm taking it you've married your lady of choice there, Mrs. Plitton. And you're there, you're thinking, oh, we've got a good bargain on these, and I've spoken to the chap and he said they're doing well. I'm thinking about having a little flutter on them. The what was the boss's conversation then? It's like, oh yeah, go on, Martin, you know what you're doing. I was like, hell no, I want to buy a sofa with that.
It's a good point, actually. So it was either that or a holiday. When we sort of completed the work on the house, and our eldest came along, so Di, my better half, said, well, we could keep that, for 6 months down the line or whatever, go away and have a holiday. And I said, well, we don't really want to be shuffling off somewhere with a small baby. It'll be a nightmare. What we'll do, we'll do this, and hopefully it'll turn out well, and we might get two holidays.
Ah, you see.
It was something like that, and I won the day.
Got
But
it.
to be fair, she's been really, really supportive all the way along. For me, she doesn't get involved in that sort of stuff, but she's very supportive, and that goes a long way, obviously.
Brilliant. No, it's really, really good to have that sort of shared sort of ownership without it being difficult. So tell us about what happened with Ibstock then. When did you trim it first time? When did you exit it first time? How long did you hold it, etc., please?
I didn't exit until they were taken over. They were taken over, off the top of my head, I think it was about 73 pence. And I actually bought some more when they were about 38p because they were recovering. But it was a few years I held them. And I think from memory, Marley was taken over actually before Ibstock.
Oh,
Marley,
okay.
I bought around about 60 odd pence, and a few more at 70. They were yielding something like 5.5% at the time as well. And they were
Excellent.
taken over, I think from memory, about £1.40. But
Excellent.
both, the point was that both were in a recovery mode, but they were also undervalued, which was one of the first things. Because one thing I will add, that before I ever made an investment, I used to do dummy runs. So I got books out of the library and used to buy the FT religiously, not if not every day, most days, and I'd track stocks. So I went more or less a whole year just looking at stocks and doing an imaginary investment, because for me, I wanted to make sure that I understood what I was doing.
Absolutely spot on.
And I didn't want to, just go in blind. I think that's still the case today. I think I always describe it as a bit like peeling an onion. You've got all these layers, and you think that you've learned a lot, but you continually learn more and more from different people
Absolutely.
and from experiences.
Absolutely spot on, mate. Every single day in the market is a school day. We've seen one. What day are we on now? Last week, saw one. Was supposedly, one of the better companies that we've got in the on the stock market. We've got a year of, I don't know, 50 odd, 60 plus elections around the world. And then the one that we've got that does the polling and the da-da-da-da-da-da and the market research and all things to do with elections, YouGov comes out and goes, sorry to tell you, sorry to forewarn you, to profit warning Bosch, down 40 odd plus percent over on the day. And institutions and recent investors and long-term investors are looking at the share price being essentially halved and taking it back to where it was 5 years ago. And I'm going, what? Where did that come from? It's not a company here of many people talking about, which is nice. So it's not been overly ramped or anything, but it just seemed a little bit left field in the sense of, really? How come they didn't forewarn or say anything to the market prior to that, given the fact of what they're in? They're in the business of sharing information and market research. Share that with the people that own your shares, mate. I just didn't get it. Didn't get it. Did you see that, Henry, last week? Sorry, Martin, go on.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And you see so many instances, don't you, where companies suddenly come out with something that absolutely smacks the share price, and you think to yourself, why have they handled it the way they have? And what I'm trying to say is that if you look back on some of these cases, you'll find a company that, it's greatly, weighted to the second half. And if you look at it and what they've done on the first half, and if you trawl back historically what they've done, you think to yourself, have they got any chance of doing that? Have they really got any chance of doing that? And, too often you see further down the line, it comes out on, perhaps on a Friday morning, that they're going to miss expectations, and not just miss them, but by a wide mark. Whereas they've had the opportunity to be open and outright, that second half waiting, is it realistic? Get out there. I mean, that's one of the things I feel quite strongly with, companies. I think they've got bad news, get it out. It's no good trying to put a sticking plaster over it, and because it just comes back to haunt them, and it's detrimental to everybody concerned, particularly the investor.
Indeed, I mean, one of my things when I was looking at it last week, when I saw it just getting absolutely creamed, and I looked at the history behind it and all the rest of it, and I thought, oh, almost like you go, oh, when you do that thing, that's the reason potentially why there was no conversations about it. And Stephen Shakespeare and the then future Chancellor of the Exchequer, Nadim Zahawi, formed YouGov in 2000. Are you thinking, okay, enough said. Henry, did you see that last week?
Did you see anything
about YouGov?
Yeah, I mean, YouGov's always been one of those companies to me that's looked insanely expensive. Everybody thinks it's a miracle company, but it does. Basically polling. They didn't really seem to have any moat to me, and I've never owned them, but they've always seemed like a highly rated name. I was quite shocked to see how far the shares have fallen, and then particularly with this update, for them to fall another 40% in a day or whatever it was, that's not the kind of share price movement you want as an investor at all. And I with the political ties it's got as well, not one for me, I don't think.
Oh, definitely not one for me.
I'll
usually, now it's, sorry, go on.
I was going to say, on the front loading of results and knocking back of forecasts, I noticed that Wynnstay had an update today. If you don't know the company, they're an agricultural supplies business. They work in the same sort of sector as Anpario, which you may have heard of. They're both small cap businesses. They provide feed and fertilizers and so on for farmers. The share price hasn't done terrifically well over the last couple of months, and all you've got to do is look out the window to see why. It's been rain, 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 and so farmers haven't been able to get out in the fields planting. But like Martin says, the trading update that they've put out to me read really well. It was quite on the nose, quite honest. Hey guys, we've not had a great 6 months. Look at what the weather's done, but we've built up some cash reserves. We've got a pipeline of opportunities coming down the road. We've had a rough 6 months, but we think things will get better. It's not going to totally make up for everything though. And that was the overwhelming feeling I got. You know, here's a management team that's really trying to talk to the shareholders, yeah, as opposed to other businesses where they're going, we know we've just had a car crash, but trust us, it's all fine.
Yeah, we'll make it up in the other half. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So Martin, tell us about when you see that, because I don't know if enough people look at that enough. I know me, Henry and I look at it, and you know, oh, that ominous, oh, we'll make it up in the second half. We're about 30% behind, right? But we'll make up the other 70% in the second half. You're like going, really, yeah, guys? You know what I mean? Come on, pull the other one. The last year, you managed 55% of what you needed to manage in the second half. You're going to really accelerate it by?
Yeah.
I don't think so. So that's a nice, I mean, we're always talking about risks here and what to look out for. You know, so when did you start noticing that sort of amber flag, and has it made you consider, you know, sometimes reducing your holdings in a stock when you see that, or in fact sometimes going, no, I'm out of here regarding a holding?
I think it's a really interesting point. So to be fair, I sort of hit on that important aspect through getting burned, basically.
Same here too, mate. Same here too.
Yeah. So at that point, you ask yourself, what did I miss? What did I do wrong? Because ultimately, it's down to you yourself. You take the decision to buy yourself. I've gone back over stuff and looked and thought, well, yeah, there's some insight here. Or, you know, look at other reputable posters, and there's some, you know, a big, big, big audience out there, you know, people commentating the whole time, some great people, and you learn from other people. So you use that collectively, and that sort of dictated my investment strategy going forward. So I do top slice, because for me, it's important to lock profit in. I think as well, a reputation of the company is very important. So you can run with your winners. If you believe in the management and what they're doing. And I think if you get the whiff of something being seriously wrong, make for the exit door. I think importantly, it's about balance sheet, isn't it? You know, if a company's under the cosh and they get hit, they're getting hit on multiple fronts, then so you're on the back foot. And particularly in the smaller cap or micro cap space, you don't want to be overexposed, because sometimes it can be hard enough to build a position. It's even harder to get out.
Absolutely spot on. Absolutely spot on. Any thoughts on that, Henry?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, people listen to a lot of investing gurus when they invest. You know, people like Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger and so on. And I think Charlie Munger it was that said, if I like a company, I'll never top slice it, because if I like it, I want to keep it and I want more of it. And if I don't like it, I don't want any of it. That's very, very different for retail investors like you and I, who frankly can't afford to lose 60, 70, 80% of a position if they get it wrong, you know. And I think we've got to be more nimble. I am a long-term investor. You know, I don't chop and change a lot. I will stick with things through thick and thin. But you also have to be sensible. You know, if you've had 100% gain on something, how much more do you think it's going to go up? 200, 300, 400%, 500%, because I've seen just as many positions that have gone up 100% from my buy price roll over and go all the way back down.
Yeah.
And if you've top sliced, you're a genius investor. If you've held on to it, you've got nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah, totally agree. Yeah.
This is a quick hello to you, our valued Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener. Whatever channel you're listening to, please make sure to subscribe and you'll always be the first to get the new episodes. Thank you for your continued support.
Absolutely. Now, Martin, I'm just going to let Henry just talk about one stock, then we're going to come back and talk about a couple of stocks that you've bought recently or currently hold, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Because I know Henry's got this thing about this pawn shop for looking for stuff. That's, you go, where's that? Who's that? So I'm hoping that because we've got a guest, he's going to at least talk about something that we both, well, you know about, and hopefully I know about as well. So Henry, we're having a break here to let you just indulge yourself. So where are you going, mate? What are you going to talk
Excellent.
About?
I've got a topic today and a batch of shares, which I think you're both going to be really, really interested in.
Cool.
So
that's a no then.
Before I launch into this, I should say that a lot of this research hasn't actually been done by me. I'm actually repeating somebody else's research. There was a report published today by a company called Hardman & Co., who are independent researchers. They produce company and sector-related reports and help small-cap companies to communicate with shareholders, basically. And they've got a whole range of sector specialists covering everything from telecoms to life sciences to financial services. And they've got a chap, they employ a chap called Dr. Martin Hall, who has written and released a report highlighting movement in the Hardman Healthcare Index. Now, to give you Martin's background, he's a qualified pharmacist from the School of Pharmacy, University of London. And he has a PhD in neuropharmacology, also from the University of London.
Wow.
And after 2 years of postdoctoral research under a Royal Society fellowship at the Collège de France in Paris, he became a leader in biochemical pharmacology at Parke Davis Research Centre in Cambridge. Hence the possible interest from Martin. Now, Dr. Hall's career in the city started in 1987 when he was employed as a healthcare analyst at Morgan Grenfell and then UBS before joining HSBC as their head of global pharmaceutical and healthcare equity research. And he's worked for Hardman & Co. as their healthcare equity research lead since 2013. So I give you all that information as a way of saying this is a guy that knows the healthcare sector, basically.
He knows his onions, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Now, Hardman & Co. have put together this thing called the Hardman Healthcare Index, which is comprised of a little over 50 life sciences companies, most of which are micro-caps and pre-profit small-caps, covering things like pharmaceuticals and biotechnology in the healthcare sector. Now, the reason they're looking at this space is because an awful lot of these businesses, if they're successful, can have huge potential gains. These are businesses that develop groundbreaking new cancer drugs or vaccines or new scientific instruments that go on to really revolutionize things in the medical sector. And in this report that Dr. Hall's written, he says that, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, most research firms and most hedge funds actually had specialized small cap healthcare analysts that were specialists in the sector. It's quite a complicated sector. If you've not got a background in pharmacology, understanding the development of drugs and the life cycle of drugs, it's quite a complex business. And over the years, most of these researchers have seemingly fallen by the wayside. MiFID II, which was some European legislation, clamped down on the amount of research that was being issued. And an awful lot of specialist funds sort of got too big for the sector. So they didn't want to invest in small caps and micro caps. Or they sort of lost interest because the research wasn't there. And so this has meant that of the, 50 plus life science businesses that Hardman's looking at in its index, they're starting to see an awful lot of funding problems for the sector. And they think that there are sort of hidden gems in the sector that are getting thrown out with the bathwater as everybody's stampeding out the door looking at things like Nvidia. Now, I don't know an awful lot about the pharmaceutical sector, but the report really interested me. So I started having a look at it, and Dr. Hall has basically covered three main issues that he thinks are prevalent in the healthcare sector, I'll say. One is that a lot of these small caps and micro caps, when they're pre-profit, they're quite capital intensive. They need a lot of funding to do the research, to develop the drugs, to undertake the testing and the commercialization of new products. And this requires capital. If capital is not available, the companies often fold, or they're forced to dilute shareholders quite dramatically. Now, there were a couple of names that sprang out at me. Allergy Therapeutics, the ticker is AGY, which is a pioneering immunology business with specialist experience in the research and development of allergy treatments. So think things like allergies to, hay fever or cats and dogs or whatever, pets. Now, the company issued shares recently at just 1p a share. But the prevailing share price was 6.25p prior to the rights issue. The company had to issue at a massive discount to get the equity raise away. And since then, the shares have increased back to 5p a share. I think at the time of this recording, they were trading at 5.25p. So if you'd taken up that rights issue, you'd be sat on a five bagger today,
Wow.
which is quite shocking because I don't hear anybody talking about allergy therapeutics.
No.
The second issue that sprang up was that a lot of these businesses, if they aren't getting the valuations that they want to see, they're agreeing to be taken private. So they delist from the stock market altogether. And Dr. Hall mentioned Redx Pharma, the ticker was REDX, which was a clinical stage biotechnology company focused on the discovery and development of small molecule targeted medicines for the treatment of fibrotic diseases, cancer, and cancer-associated fibrosis. There was 4X Discovery, the ticker was C4XD, which earlier this year announced the decision to delist and be taken private. And the company was working in the discovery and development of small molecule medicines for immuno-inflammatory diseases. Now, these delistings, if you like, aren't really great for private shareholders like the three of us and our listeners, because you're basically left with two choices. Either you sell your shares on the public market at a discount, because usually when the shares are delisted, they're not taken over, they're just delisted and they're taken private. The share price collapses, so you're forced to sell at a massive loss. Or you end up holding a position in a company that's now, it's got no liquidity in it, it's a completely private holding, it's off market, which isn't great. So both of these issues are starting to drive private shareholders out of the market. Finally, this lack of interest, both from retail investors and from institutions, is causing an awful lot of the names in the sector to consider moving abroad. So, one of the names that was touted in this report was Convatec. The ticker is CTEC. It's a global medical products and technologies company focused on solutions for the management of chronic conditions with market-leading positions in advanced wound care, ostomy care, continence care and infusion care. The shares yield 2.5%, a bit under that, I think. It's got a positive return on capital, 8.5%. It's forecast to grow. Earnings per share growth is actually accelerating. It's due to grow its earnings per share at 12.5% next year against a trailing 3-year average of 3%. And you can buy the shares on a relatively untaxing PE of 19 times, which for a growing pharmaceuticals business, I would suggest is relatively untaxing. But there's been talk in the market that this business may well delist and go over to America because they're so fed up with the UK undervaluing them. Now, the whole report is available on Hardman's website, which is hardmanandco.com. And I'd recommend any listeners go there and go and read the report in full because it's quite interesting. But I just wanted to throw out there to you guys, are you looking at the pharmaceutical space, any small caps, micro caps? And what's your take on their ability to raise equity? And, you know, how do you feel about the space generally?
Let Martin go first if you want to, Martin. Is that, you're in the life sciences space around the, you know, the triangle.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a sector that I get too involved in. I'm a investor, having bought a few in that sector during COVID, you know, which I think everybody did. Avacta, stuff like that, which was more of a, you know, a bit of a punt than anything, which isn't my usual strategy. But they were strange times. But to answer your question, I find that too many of those, you know, that are emerging, they have such long timelines with trials, proof of efficacy, and, you know, it's a constant, you know, drain on money. You know, it's they're so cash draining that, you know, your timeline is way out there. And, you know, it's very high risk. There are some, you know, around the edge of that that provide support services. I quite like Diacutics, which I do hold, but it's, you know, it's not a pharma play, as in it's not developing drugs and stuff like that. It's providing the support and giving them the tools to develop drugs. So it's a different thing altogether. I don't know whether that helps, but that's my sort of take. It's not something that I'd be exploring.
That's fair, Peter.
Yeah, I think it goes back to what you were saying, Martin, about, you know, investing in what you understand. And a lot of these are quite complicated, and unless you know what they actually do, and you've got some sort of, you know, relationship with that sort of healthcare sector for a variety of different reasons, it's hard to actually quantify what they're doing, how they're doing it, how long it's going to take to actually get there. You know, how many times are they going to actually have to come back to the market to get some more money, which is often the reason why they've listed. So the early stage sort of ones, it's very, very hard. I go back to when I was in a stock, I think it was 4D, and everyone was involved in that. Everyone got into that quite late, and then it got absolutely creamed. So you've always got to be very careful, either get in early when people start to finally get a sort of sense of the potentials here. If they do this right and this right and this right, then it's going to be worth this. And they've got a target market that's worth this amount, and the share price just goes off to the races. But it gets to the phase two or phase three, and it goes, and the share price then collapses. You've got to be ever so careful. So I'm in that sort of space, but way further up the food chain, in the sense of, you know, AstraZeneca being the penultimate number one, number two company listed in the UK. This covers that sort of space. I'm not on that sort of level, on a granular level. And probably the nearest thing I've got to that is something which is you wouldn't even say that's in that space, but it's a specialty chemical sort of company. But if you're going for the companies that are right on the very low level starting out, my question is always is and continues to be, well, if there's a possibility of them getting that, to say the word, cure, or getting that to phase three, why is their market cap only 20 million quid or 50 million quid? Why is it not a multi-billion pound company? And if they are going to get anywhere near that, they're going to be taken over by a multi-billion pound company at some stage anyway. So you've got to be ever so careful, because there's very few of that. You mentioned 50 plus companies, I think, Henry, that will make it out of that 50 to become a multi-billion pound company, or even a 250, 500 billion. Yeah, 500 million to a billion pound company. So, you know, it's hard. It really is hard. And that sort of areas is full of, it's a graveyard. You know, so many companies don't make it out of constant fundraise. And like the one that you mentioned there, was it was it Allergy, the Allergy one that came
Yes,
and
yeah.
did that raise? I think I saw the meltdown actually, if
Allergy
I remember rightly.
therapeutics, yeah.
Yeah, that because they were at six pence, like I think you said, Henry, and then they did the fundraise down there at one, and everyone went, "Oof, what that?" You know, effing and jeffing all over Twitter and X. It's like, what are you doing? And other companies that have just gone, you know what? Share price is 40p now. We can't raise the money. We're going to take it private for 50 for 5 pence now. Bye bye. And the share price have collapsed. So you've got to be ever so careful. You know, it goes back to what
Yeah.
Martin was saying about the integrity of the management and you know, knowing the company inside out and spending time watching what they're doing and all the rest of it. Because there's a couple, there's lots of lifestyle companies across the whole of the FTSE and AIM, and the smaller the market cap, you've got to be ever so careful. So
Yeah.
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 I
I'm
think the
just
thing
going
that, sorry,
to,
go on,
sorry, is
Martin.
it, yeah, I'm just going to throw one other that I bought during COVID, which I
Go
actually
for it.
did quite well. That's Biodynamics,
Yep.
but it's a classic case where they've munched through the money, and although they appear to have some decent tech, and they've announced various deals and collaborations, in terms of achieving revenue, it just isn't happening, and it's now back down to about 7p. They've done another raise earlier this year. And you just wonder, what the ultimate end game is, because, as you say, Pete, it's different, with a 20 million market cap compared to the big boys who have got that revenue flowing through, and they're generating the cash.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, good call there, Henry. Good subject matter there. I suspect there'll be one or two that make it, Henry. But you're going to have to be, you know, threading through the eye of a needle, I think, regarding that sector.
I
And
think
I dare say they'll have to come back to the market and they'll get some good news. They'll get some. I mean, it's all about partnerships. A lot of those, isn't it? Oh, we've got a deal with this, and if we get this done, we'll get £100 million here or £50 million there, and so on and so forth. It's all about partnerships and collaborations as such in
I
that
think
space.
that's the thing. I mean, the thing that really struck me after reading the report was the lack of insight I actually had into how these businesses function. So there are 50 businesses here doing 50 different things. I mean, they're not, they're, broadly speaking, they're all life sciences, but the actual mechanics of how these companies will operate over the next 10 years, very, very limited insight on my part. And this is why I quite enjoy Martin's blog, to be honest, because it gives you some insight into how the businesses operate. It gives you some insight into the sector. Fine, it's not a foolproof, source of knowledge. I don't expect Martin to know everything about, the company, but it's quite insightful. And I think that as investors, we're lacking that research a lot of the time. And I think that's a weak spot, because certainly there is a trend for a lot of these businesses delisting and going abroad. The Americans love them. If you look at the gap in valuation between the UK life sciences market and the US life sciences market, it's vast. You've got, dare I say the name, Cathie Wood's over there that's managed to raise hundreds of millions of dollars. Admittedly, I think she's also incinerated hundreds of millions of dollars, but the money's been raised. And she's not the only name in that space trying that sort of thing. I'll use her as the poster child, perhaps unfairly. But it's an interesting space. So yeah, I'd recommend readers go away and have a look at that research report, because it was quite insightful.
Yeah, thank you for that. And most I interviewed the one of the founders of Hardman. I think his name is Keith Hiscox, and he's brilliant. And you can sign up for most of the data for the research and be on their mailing list, and you can get some insightful research just sent out to you on a regular basis. And they cover the whole gamut of the stock market as well. So definitely worth a read. And that chap that you mentioned, who wrote that particular article, sounds overqualified, mate. It's like he's a rocket scientist, you know, absolutely phenomenal quality of people that they actually have working for the company. Right, I've got two stocks to talk about, but I'm going to go back to Martin because I'm conscious of the time. I'm going to just flip through the two stocks I've got. Martin, I wanted to talk to you about a couple of stocks you currently hold, if possible.
Yeah.
and some of the journeys that those couple of stocks have had, good, bad, or indifferent. And
Yeah.
just share with us as well, because the most important thing that Henry and I try and share on this, and Phil, when he's here with us, is about the quality of research that you participate in. You're going meeting these individuals as well, because some of them are nearby. You're doing Zoom calls with the CEOs and CFOs on occasions in the past. How much time, what do you do, how much level of importance do you put on the research, and not just going, oh, you know what, I listened to the podcast and Henry said X and I've gone and bought it.
Well, there's a lot in there, Pete. So coming to stocks first. So I hold IG Design, ticker is IGR. So I bought them earlier this year at 112 as a recovery play. And I was lucky enough to speak with the management. So they've got a revamped management team, very experienced. And when I spoke to them, I wanted to know obviously a lot about the business. So they're into gift wrap, Christmas crackers, it could be cards, anything within that sector. And I mistakenly thought that birthday cards, Christmas cards was probably quite a big part of their business, given that the margins across the business were very, very low. And I very quickly learned that it's a very, very tiny piece of their business. And it's something they don't, ascribe a lot of value to. They do it because it's really just, within their whole business, sort of operation. So speaking with management, they were very open, and they told me that the business had been, although it was all under one group, it was very fragmented. And they had situations where one part of the business was dealing with a supplier that was in competition with another, but they were equally overlapping when they shouldn't have been, if you get the drift. So what the idea was, they should be sourcing together as one entity as opposed to separate businesses. Management gave me the clear sort of vision of what their plans were, and they were improving the margins. They'd got the debt down, cash generative again, and it was going the right way. And I just looked at it and basically across the business, what they were doing, given that they obviously in a difficult market because the global economy is difficult, full stop. But they seem to have the right strategy, and so far so good. They brought results out today. I spoke with them again today. They rightly highlight a few headwinds, but they're confident or sound confident on delivering on the forecasts that are out now, reinstating the dividend. I did press them as to whether they would opt for an interim dividend or wait for the full year. And suffice to say, it's something that they're monitoring. But the key aspect there is that a reinstatement of the dividend is very much on the agenda. Interestingly, they've got some properties that they're selling: property in Pennsylvania, another one in Wales, and I think there's a third, which they reckon will generate about $10 million, which is above what the book value is at the moment. They're also they've ch op closed down an operation in China which produced Christmas crackers, a decision that they've taken quite quickly, because there are other operators out there who can do it much cheaper, hence you're getting squeezed. So they've shut that down, and I think that's indicative of the approach to this management team. Now the shares are, I don't know what they closed at today, but they're I think around about 225, 26. So they've had a good run. Short term, there could be some profit taking, could ease off a little bit, but I think that it wouldn't need too much improvement in the global economy going forward. I think they're already on track to hit those forecasts that are out there. So I think that medium to long term, I think it's a story that's back on track and evolving. I think that they'll continue to do well. But there could be an opportunity, anybody else that's interested in looking at it, if there is a bit of profit taking, there could be an opportunity there.
Brilliant. No, thank you for that insight. I mean, the first question I've got for you, because I'm not using a euphemism here, but usually with the wrapping and the papers and the packaging and all that sort of thing, the margins are paper thin, aren't
Yeah.
they? What sort of margins have you got? Henry's shaking his head because he knows what I'm trying to do here. What are the margins like, Martin?
Yeah, I haven't got them in front of me, but I think, I mean, basically, they've got the margins back up to what they were pre-COVID.
Right, okay.
They've demonstrated that they can do it, and most of that has been done by sort of self-help measures. Basically, from what I said at the outset, where they've looked at the business and said, look, this arm isn't talking to that one. So we need to really put in place the right processes to make things function. And they're getting, I think they're getting the right deals with their suppliers and the people that they're working with. But I think that's down to the management. I think the previous management, I wasn't involved with them. I wasn't a shareholder at that point. But having looked back, which I've done. It just appeared to me that they'd sort of taken their eye off the ball. They obviously were hit by things outside their control, but I just felt that they sort of lost their way a bit, and this new team looked pretty switched on to me. And they also they have like design licenses that they hold, which are quite important, and that sort of makes up quite a large slice of their business, as opposed to the obvious stuff. Like I said, you'd think cards could be a major part, which it isn't. So and I think with the dividend back on the agenda as well, I think
Yeah.
they could go on and do well. I mean, like I said, they've had a very good run. And I was surprised that they were as weak as what they were when I bought them. I mean, they did, after I bought them at 112, they did drop to about 107, 106, I think, before
It's not bad. That's not bad, though. It's not bad. No, very well done. Good timing. It's always nice to get a company when it's unloved and cheap. And then it gets a re-rating because the management, new management or otherwise, actually execute on what they're saying they're going to do. And then profits going forward look to be up. Margins looks like it's going to be up. They're going to introduce the dividend. All that attracts not only new investors, but institutions which tend to be stickier, and if they're coming in now at 220 plus, they're going to want their 10, 20, 30% on the shares over the next year, 2 years as well. So yeah, very, very good chat there, mate. Good call and good and fantastic timing in getting there at the low £1 to have it essentially double. And have you looked at greeting cards, for
I
rarity or as an
have.
investment?
I'm less interested in it, unfortunately. I like the story a lot, and I think you kudos to you for getting to know the business. And if they do what they say they're going to do, that's a lot of ticks in a lot of boxes there. The bit I don't like is actually what they do. So the manufacturing of, well, design manufacturing of celebration crafts, stationery, that kind of stuff, it feels quite old economy to me, if that makes sense. So my generation, I very rarely send things like Christmas cards and birthday cards. I send a handful. My grandmother, on the other hand, would sit for days and send hundreds of the things. It doesn't feel like a space that's going to have a lot of growth in it. So I feel like they're going to be fighting against a lot of headwinds to turn that business round. Doesn't mean they can't do it, just I reckon there's easier fish to fry out there.
Yeah,
Sorry, I
fair
think
point.
in defense, I think its turnaround's already happening. And you
The
know what I
share
think
price
when they got
certainly reflects that. I mean, if you look at.
the share price reflects it, but also I think if you look at the almost, I'm not saying that it's all deemed to be sub teenagers sort of thing, but a lot of people like to receive gifts and they like to have it wrapped. I get told off all the time, right? Because I'm like, yeah, sweetheart, bought you this. And she looks at me, doesn't matter what it is. It's like, were you planning to wrap that? And I'm going, yeah. And off I have to go because I can't just hand it over in the bag from wherever, you know, where I purchased it. It's got to be wrapped up, Henry.
Yeah,
You know,
that's
and
just because
greeting
little
cards, you
bags
know.
aren't great, mate.
You know, but you know, you got when I buy a lot of stuff from Boots, right? The perfumes of choice, and they gift wrapped it up there. And it's like you buy it out of John Lewis, and they gift wrapped it up there, and
Yeah,
all the rest of it.
that's
And
true.
you need to come back with the presentation bag to hand it over. It doesn't matter what's in it. It's not in a nice presentation bag. It's not worth anything. So I still think that there's a catalyst there. We've gone far too techie. I get sent, you know, stuff through emails like "Happy birthday, Pete." I'm like, "Yeah, thanks for that." It's like a digital card, you
Yeah.
know. I'm like, not really feeling it. Yeah, thanks, sort of thing. So I still think there's time. I don't think we're going to go everything digital. And you are right, it's a generational thing, you know. My daughter must, you know, she's 16. She's like, I said, Ebs, you know, it's prom. You know, are you going to take any gifts for anybody? Are you going to wrap anything? She's like, you don't do that, Dad. I'm like, oh, all right, fine, fine. You know what I mean? So it is what it is. But I
It
still.
feels very difficult to have a clear differentiator in that sector. So I'm not necessarily saying that these things are going to disappear. I can't see a world in which we're not going to be giving gifts to each other. That's totally not what I'm saying. It's more about the fact
Wraps
that,
gifts.
your gift wrap could be made by anybody, anywhere, at any time. It's not a particularly complex thing to manufacture and sell. And therefore, why are you going to have a competitive margin to do it?
Can I just come in there, Henry?
Go for it.
Because it's a really important point what you raise. And when I chatted with the CEO and CFO first time round, I raised that, if not the very point, around that sort of periphery. And they were explaining to me that across the whole world, because they're a global operation, but particularly in Europe, where they're now sort of focusing on for growth, it's extremely fragmented, and a lot of the smaller players have been seriously hit on the back of COVID. A lot of them are either disappearing or struggling. Now, given that IG deals with the likes of Walmart or Sainsbury's, Tesco's, John Lewis as well now, I believe. So they're dealing with big outlets. And the other thing, tagging on to that, your point about, obviously I get it, generation change, but the UK is, I would say, slightly different to, some of the other places. So, for example, in the States, and I know IG suffered a bit in the States, but historically and even today, gift wrap and all that sort of stuff and all the things that go with it. It's big in the US. They love all that. And I can't see that sort of changing. So, I get exactly what you're saying, and I think it's important to take that on board. But I just think, given the fragmented nature of it, and coming back to your point, there are lots of small players out there, anybody can do this sort of thing, but it's whether they can do it in volume and do it right as well. And they are looking for key differentiators on stuff that they're putting out, as opposed to something that is not particularly topical.
I really like that
Cool.
answer. I can't argue with any of that. And that's the benefit of getting to know the business and doing your own research. You know, that is it through and through, because I can come out with a generic point not knowing the business. You've got an answer for that. So
Yeah.
if you're still holding, I wish you every luck with it.
Yeah. Cheers.
Brilliant. I'm going to change topic now, Martin, briefly. I'm going to talk about two stocks simultaneously. And I'm going to ask you guys a question regarding to sector as to where you think this particular company could be given its PE earnings, right? So PE, this stock last Thursday went to IPO with a PE of 550, right? What sector do you think it would be in?
It's a tech
To you,
stock.
Martin.
A
To you, Mark. Say again.
tech stock.
tech stock. Okay. Henry, Viola hair, what are you saying? You're shaking your head going, uh-oh, Pete's coming with
I think it's a
something here.
retailer.
You're saying it's a retailer. Right. Okay. I'm talking about a fast food joint, a
Oh.
Mexican themed fast food joint, mate, with a PE coming to IPO of 550. You're going, what? It's got to be a tech stock. It's got to be something amazing. No, guys.
Someone really wanted
This
a kebab on a Friday night.
this was the initial public offering of a Mexican themed fast food chain called Guzman Gomez. And it went off like a rocket last Thursday, right? Bizarrely surging 36%, giving it a market cap of over 3 billion at one stage, loss making, right? And it just that it just caught my attention. And the reason why I'm talking about it was because it was the biggest ASX listing on the Australian Stock Exchange, I must add as well, for 3 years, with a float of 335 million Australian dollars, bearing in mind that the current valuation is 2.9 Australian dollars. If I said American, then apologies. So 2.9 billion Australian dollars, which is equivalent of 1.5 billion, just over pounds. And essentially, they popped last Thursday at a 30% gain from the IPO of 20, £22, $22 a share. And it's a proper hyped company. Everyone's raving about it in the Australia. And essentially, they sell burritos. If you want to be, very, very tactless as to what they do, but they offered the franchisees, which they've got, an opportunity to purchase them at 18, and they opened up at 22, and they went up to 31 almost. And the current enterprise valuation is that EBITDA of 32.5 times. All the red flags that Henry hates regarding the particular stock. Absolute valuation, absolutely staggering. Loss making, not planning to make any money for a little while. And essentially, you've got a company which, on branding, it's a bit like Fevertree, where everyone goes whoop, 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 went all over it. And they're still buying the shares now. A week later, it's closed at £29 per share. And I'm just sitting here going, how did that happen? How did a company that couldn't sell itself to private equity end up being engineered for a listing and IPO with a PE of 550, and it's a fast food joint that sells Mexican wraps.
Whether you are an experienced or new investor, you know how valuable it is to conduct portfolio enhancing analysis and to have easy access to data that will give you the edge. As a Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener, you can access an exceptional offer via SharePad from ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. This special Twin Peaks offer is available to new subscribers only, and you can subscribe using the promo code TWINPEETS. The incredible and exclusive offer means that monthly subscribers will get their second month free, and annual subscribers will get their 13th month free. Sign up and subscribe to SharePad today using the Twin Peaks promo code, and you can save up to £69. Visit sharescope.co.uk/sharepad for further details and subscribe to the investing and trading analysis and data you need.
Unbelievable.
Any answers there? You're
I
shaking
can
your head,
believe
Martin.
that. I can believe that.
And
Well,
it's not
we
because it's in
spoke about
Australia. It's
Chipotle Mexican
you
Grill
know,
about
it's
6 months
it just
back.
staggered me. It just absolutely staggered me. I'm like, what the hell happened there?
No, I can
You
believe
know,
that. Convince
it's got a
people it's
hundred.
going to be the next McDonald's and that'll take off.
Yeah.
I mean,
Well,
it
I don't know
already
what the
has.
hype is. It's got 183 stores, mate, and it's not a lot. It's loss making, and essentially, you're selling an IPO at seven times revenue. Yeah,
Yeah, but it's
they're looking to hit
IPOs are all about the marketing, the brand, the
the
image, the
narrative. Yes,
potential,
agreed,
right?
agreed, agreed.
So if you're selling burritos for 50p each and you've got queues round the block down the street and you've got drones coming in and picking even more up, you can't get these things out the door fast enough because you're selling them so cheap, right? And you're going to go from 1,800 stores to 183,000 stores around the world in 10 years' time. Providing you can keep convincing people that you're going to get there, they'll keep throwing money at it because if they think it's going to be the next McDonald's or the next Chipotle Mexican Grill or whoever,
It's just a bit.
I
It's just
can
a bit.
believe that. I don't think it's a great investment, incidentally. I think you'd be absolutely mad to buy it
Listen,
at
this is
that
not what
PE,
I'm. This
but.
is what I'm trying to. When I get to the point I'm trying to make is, it's one I think you should avoid, right? And if you, we've got a few listeners over in Australia. If you're watching this, if you get the opportunity, I'm, because it's a trading sort of piece of narrative here, I'd short that out of it. I really, really would. So. Pre-IPO, they raised 135 million Australian earlier in the year, valuing the business at $18 a share, or 1.76 billion Australian. And then 6 months later, it's now worth 2.9 billion. I'm like, what happened there? Yeah, where's that other 1.2 billion come from? Like,
Well,
being missing out.
here's another red flag for you. I've just given them a quick Google. They were established by Steve Marks, a New Yorker who previously worked as a hedge fund manager. If that's
So
someone
he's
that's not
connect.
used to taking money off other people.
Careful, careful, careful. Right. So that's for me. It's just a guys, if you're listening in Australia or elsewhere, that's an avoid for me. Unless somebody, from McDonald's decides that they need to buy it. I just don't understand the valuation of that whatsoever. The ticker symbol in Australia is GYG. Get yourself gone, as in get yourself out of there. Right. So on the back of that, it made me think, have we got anything similar going on in the UK or elsewhere? And obviously everyone knows, and they might say actually that's not quite the same in the American ones. Chipotle is the name, and maybe that's not quite the same over in the US. But we've got Tortilla Mexican listed on AIM, right? I know Martin, you live in rurally, but in Cambridge, but I'm sure you've had a Mexican when you've been out. Have you not? Never?
Yeah, but not for some time.
Yeah, not for some time because of what happened last time you had some. I understand. Okay, won't go there. All right. So we've got Tortilla Mexican Grill. Okay, IPO'd, or sorry, raised some monies in September 2021. Gross proceeds of 5 million, raised 23 million all told from selling shareholders, and then it capitalized at 70 million and then listed in October 2021 with a market cap of 70 million, as I said, per share at £1.81 October 2021. Today, the share price is 57 pence. Today had a good day. It was up 9% as well. And the year to date range is 37 pence to 94 pence. Market cap, 20 million. I'm thinking, 20 million versus 1.5 equivalent billion pounds.
I've got to stop you there, Peter. Have
No,
you
no, no,
looked?
please don't stop. Please don't stop me just yet, Henry, right? What they've done. Right, is they've gone and bought. They're currently the largest and most successful fast casual Mexican restaurant in the UK. And what they've done is they've gone and bought one of the largest competitors in Europe, right, for peanuts. And I'm thinking, if this is, because it's one of the hottest sort of segments at the moment in Mexican food, apparently across Europe. If they can buy this other competitor for peanuts, right, and they can actually continue their growth. And roll out the franchise and improve their margins. From 20 million, there's room for growth. At already 3 billion, I'm like, that's like 2 billion overpriced already. Yeah. I'm not saying this is perfectly priced or fairly priced, but I'd rather invest in something that's worth 20 million with a view to it growing over the next 5 to 10 years as a growing franchise model. Yeah. Rather than something at 30 billion. Sorry, 3 billion, that says it's going to go into America and elsewhere. and they're going into Europe already by buying it rolls into France by buying its competitor, European competitor called Fresh Burritos. So that's why I'm bringing those two to the table, as in potentially avoid Guzman Gomez, but have a look, dig down, go and taste the food, go and do what Martin does, go and have a little visit to one of their restaurants and check out the burritos that Tortilla Mexican do and see what they do with the grill and whether it's any good, and keep a track of it and see what happens. And in July next month, well, when this podcast goes out, we'll still be out. Have a look at what they say with regard to the results in July. Is there any potential there? I don't know. I'm just saying, I'm not even considering that one over there. That's already worth, valued at, not worth, 3 billion Australian. There's a 20 million little nugget here that potentially could do something over the next 3 to 5 years. Anyway, I'll go to Henry first so we can assassinate it, and then I'll go to you, Martin. Go on. You tried to tell me to stop already, so
I've got to say. Let's just have a look under the bonnet on this one, ladies and gents, because I've just pulled this up on SharePad. Pays no dividend, which I'm not particularly keen on, but it's a growth company, right? So we're going to shoot the lights out on growth, rolling franchises out all over the place. Only problem is forecast growth is slowing down. So turnover, average 3-year growth of 35%. Next year, 10%. What's caused that huge drop-off if they're going to start rolling out across France? No forecast earnings per share growth, no pre-tax earnings growth. Return on capital employed gives me a nosebleed, 1.7%. 1.7%. I mean, for every pound that you put into the business, you get 1p back. This business to me just looks like a disaster waiting to happen when you look at the debt as well, because it's got a debt to market cap ratio of 173% and a fixed charge cover of just 0.4. So it's not earning much money on the cash it's got. It's borrowed most of that. Its growth is slowing down. To me, that looks like you've picked up a hand grenade and you're hoping to find the pin to put it back in. But
I love that analogy. That's a keeper, that analogy, mate. Love that. All the things you said there, mate, are proper red flags, right? Proper red flags. Absolutely. And the thing with all these sort of franchises is that it's all about compounding the growth and compounding the growth. And these things take time. It's been going for a little while now. IPO'd a little while, 3 years in. Is there room for growth regarding the Mexican market? I think so. Could they grow it in across Europe? I think so. So it's one of them. Go and research it. It's not a recommendation. It's not a tip. Go on, Martin. Carry on the assassination, mate. Thanks for that, Henry.
Yeah, well, I'll come at it from a different angle. I think Henry summed it up perfectly.
That it's crap. Carry on.
To me, there's so many of these things that come along. I mean, I can remember having a look at Franco Manca, you know, the pizza at one point, and speaking to, you know, my eldest lad and some of his friends, you know, and it's a good gauge of opinion. And it came out, you know, as being one of the better pizzas, but a pizza is a pizza. And I suspect that, you know, Mexican is Mexican. But more importantly for me is where the places are located, because, you know, I think it's important what city, what location, and, you know, there are places that, I mean, for example, for me, if a chain opens something up in Cambridge, which has always been a bit of a bubble, and they don't succeed, that tells you something. And we've had a fair few of those go by the wayside here. So it's not something that I'd be warm to. I think Henry has pointed out the real red flags. So I'd be very, very cautious. I mean, interestingly, I just tag on there, various eateries, which came to the market some years back, I think during the pandemic, and if you look at, you know, Hugh Osman, the people on board there, they've really struggled to roll out their sort of concept, and the Copper Club and their Greek offering is sort of higher end market, and they're in the sort of places where there's money, and that concept is struggling as well. So for me, I'd be very, very, very cautious. So, you know, I wouldn't be averse to maybe trying it and seeing what it's about, because I think that's important. But from what I've heard so far, it's not for me, Pete.
Absolutely, it's not for everybody. It's not for me either at the moment. I'm just bringing it to the attention. You know, you've got one that's worth valued at 3 billion, you know, Australian, and one that's a tiddle at 20. I'm like, you know, yin and yang in it, and saying, look, have a look, have a little research about it all. All the rest of it. Martin, I'm conscious of the time. If you want to share one more stock, you can. I've got Henry's going to say a little brief bit about the, not going through the names or anything, but just tell us where we're at with the charity and give people the URL as to where they can donate some money to Centrepoint. And then I want to say a little shout out for Powder Monkey Brewery here, because I know Henry likes to get his beers in from there as well.
Okay.
Did you want to say another one?
I just touched briefly on one.
Go for it.
So I'm underwater on this one. I've held it for a number of years. In the past, I've done well on it, and that's Pennant International, which is defence. They are at the, what I always describe as, at the back end of the defence food chain. So I also hold Concurrent Technologies, that's done very well. But Pennant, basically, they do a lot of training stuff. So they work on things like the Leonardo helicopters, the Apache stuff. They work with all the big boys, BAE, General Dynamics, Boeing, Lockheed. They've got a lot of work out there that they've been offered, you know, to tender for. And historically, they land a decent chunk of what they price for. And I think at the current price, 25, 26p, market cap's about 10 million. I think, you know, they are a bit speculative, but I think as a recovery play on the back of the, you know, the defence programmes coming through, I think they could do quite well in the next couple of years.
Okie dokie. Is that one you've looked at before, Henry? Is one that you've ever thought of? For some reason, I had them in my head as a recruiter for some reason for the defence sector, not the training side of it. So I've got that all wrong historically regarding them. I've never looked at them properly.
I can't say I have either, to be perfectly honest. I mean, Concurrent Technologies is one I own, so I won't go into too much detail on that one. Yep. But the defence space isn't one I've done a lot of research on, to be perfectly honest with you. So I couldn't really comment much more than that.
Yeah, okay. I mean, just briefly, I mean, Pennant historically have done predominantly hardware stuff, but they've sort of transitioned to more of a software-focused business, but in the same sector. And they're looking to sort of really get that up to 70% ARR, which basically will get rid of the lumpiness that they've endured over the years. And you'll see it's often been feast and famine with them. And as I say, in the past, I did quite well when the shares were up about £1.20. I think I sold the bulk of mine at 112. They've done a raise recently, and it's interesting. If you have a look, it looks like they had it was a failed acquisition, but reading between the lines for me, it could even have been something like a reverse takeover, so a bigger business. I've got no proof of that. Management haven't confirmed that. But I just reading the sort of info on it. So they've got a new chairman who's ex Mitan. Mitan are a major holder, and Richard Staveley is very keen. He's been building a stake up through, I think it's Rockwood, isn't it? I just think it's not an easy ride being a Pennant shareholder, but I think that a large chunk of this business could drop through in the coming months. And I think at the current level, I think if one or two of those start feeding through, the shares could recover quite quickly.
Well, thank you for that. Ticker symbol PEN as in pen. Just pulled up some notes here for it. Return to operating profit, which is about 4 days ago, it announced that, so last week. Record gross margin and growing revenue. 1.4 million software investment and strong European growth. And first commercial sales of GenS V2, which must be some software
That's right, yeah.
that they're putting across the defense market.
Yeah.
And obviously, we're given what we've seen over the past 2 years, since the Ukraine war starting, the amount of spend across the defense sector has been absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
So obviously, there's going to be more and more training required for all these different bits of kit, and so on and so forth going forward, for it. So yeah, another potential situation here where, like you say, to convert some of these revenues, as Phil always talks about, and dropping straight to the bottom line, then accelerates, doesn't it? And then people go, well, it was always a bit oof, but now, and people don't forgive us, yeah, when it's rolled over and fallen so deeply, and then they see it accelerate past where they sold it last time, and it carries on because they've forgotten that the re-rating gathers momentum. And the sentiment towards the company changes, the profitability becomes changing. And before you know it, institutions are buying the company as well as, retail investors. So yeah, I'll have to go and have a look at that one, Martin. Thank you. Because it's not one I've ever looked at properly.
Right.
A, because it's a small one and it's in defense space. And because purely ignorantly, I thought it was a recruitment firm, a tiny little recruitment firm for the defense sector, not actually doing the training for it. So
Yeah.
apologies there for my ignorance.
No, it's
Thank you
fine.
for that. Henry, anything else to add on to that one?
Yeah, it is an interesting business. I mean, I say I don't know it, so I'm not going to comment in a huge amount of detail, but there's another firm that I've been interested in watching called Kestrel Opportunities. They're a software specialist investor. Very, very hard to get details on what they're invested in, but I've crossed paths with them a few times. They used to have a holding in Smoove, which was ULS Tech that got taken over a while back. Watching what they do and the way they talk about technology firms have become increasingly interesting to me. And the Pennant International kind of model, it's a very, very small business, which makes me nervous. But that doesn't mean it's not a good business. And like you say, if you can start to get together some research about what they do and how they do it, and you can start to understand more about the potential market, that's got huge re-rating potential because, like you say, only 4 years ago, that was rated at well, nearly 10 times what it is today,
Yeah.
5 times at least. And it's not on a particularly taxing forecast PE. I mean, 22 times earnings, providing it grows and providing they sort out the revenue and the earnings, that could really start to motor. So, really interesting name. It's one that I'd want to go away and really understand, really read about.
Yeah.
But, really interesting research idea that. So, thank you.
Could I just come in with one final point on that, Henry
Yeah,
and
go for
Phil?
it.
So it's important to understand one key aspect that really hit the company was they had a contract with General Dynamics, which General Dynamics were doing the work on Ajax for the MOD. And Pennant, because they're quite niche, they were the only company that could really do the training aids for that program. Now, General Dynamics got into a few problems, so there was an overrun, and there was a bit of a spat with them and the MOD. But the bottom line was that everything got delayed, which, being a small company with sort of limited working capital or limited cash on the balance sheet, that hit Pennant. So it really sort of knocked them back. Now, interestingly, we're on the next phase of that, and it's due sort of any time in the next, even now or the next few months. My understanding, speaking with management, is General Dynamics are keen for Pennant to do the work because, really, as they've done the first phase, it would be very difficult to get somebody else to basically pick up where they left off. But Pennant have been sort of digging their heels in because they want guarantees that if there are any issues, they won't be impacted like they were before, which is a very good stance to
Yeah.
take. But my feeling is that, watch this space on that one. I think you've summed it up right, Henry. This is the way I'm seeing it. There's potentially some really good recovery there.
Brilliant. Thank you for that, Martin. Excellent synopsis of that particular potential company. Right, I'm going to go to you in a second, Henry. I'm going to quickly give a shout out. It's the weather in most places in the UK and overseas at the moment is lovely. So therefore, individuals that want to buy some choices of beers, a diverse range of beers, including pale ales and IPAs and dark ports and stouts, etc., should potentially consider making a purchase from Powder Monkey Brewery. People, those that are watching on YouTube have seen the little banner that's above my head throughout this podcast. And because they were one of the sponsors last year of the Twin Peaks Investing Challenge, and they're also continuing to support the podcast as well by allowing our listeners to make purchases from their website, which is www.powdermonkeybrewing.com. And anybody that makes a purchase that adds the little Twin Peaks name in the checkout can get a 10% off anything they purchase on that particular website. I see Martin scribbling down the name of the website as we speak because he likes his
Indeed.
beers. Good man, good man. So yeah, so if you can do, go on there and just leave a shout for Twin Peaks and you get yourself a 10% off your beers. Over to you, Henry. Tell us about how much money has been raised and just that, because we've done 2.5 hours. I'm conscious that Martin might want to go and visit his missus and say hello, Di. It wasn't as bad as it was, and these guys didn't really, beat me up too much, and I enjoyed it.
Well, just before I get into the charity, I will just say the soft sales pitch. I'm going to give you the hard sales pitch, people. Get out there and go and buy Powder Monkey Brewing beer. It's the best beer you're going to have this year. I guarantee it. In fact, I'm so confident that this beer has got magical properties because my father-in-law had a few cans of it, went to the pub and threw three triple bullseyes at the pub
Wow.
after drinking Powder Monkey Brewery beer. Now, if that is not magic beer, I don't know what is. You heard it here, people. Magic beer. So get out there and get stocked up.
Fantastic. Mate, if you can correct my lenses as well, then I'll go and drink some more as well. Thank you very much for that. Okie dokie. Go for it, mate.
Anyway,
Go for it. Tell us about what figure we're
onto the
out. And
charity. So we've
yeah,
just
please. Thank
tipped
you, mate.
over the 50% mark. We're now at 51% towards our target,
Fantastic.
£2,597 raised. We've had a
Brilliant.
very generous donation from James. I think it was perhaps James Flavin, at James Flavin on Twitter.
Oh, thank you, James.
£100 plus £25 gift aid. Great cause. Well done, Henry, Peter, and Phil. So thank you very much for tuning in, James, and for your support. If you'd like to donate to the charity, the donation page is at www.justgiving.com forward slash page forward slash Twin Peaks Challenge 24. If that's again, if you'd like to fundraise for Centrepoint with us, and contribute towards the cause, you can do so at justgiving.com forward slash page forward slash Twin Peaks Challenge 24. All donations are very gratefully received.
Brilliant. And thank you again, James Slavin, for a brilliant donation. Got to mention our super duper co-host, Phil. As you can see, he's not on this particular pod. Phil's taking some time out. He's got lots going on regarding his work, trying to get rebalanced again. So we're going to hopefully see him back in September, if not a little bit sooner. We'll keep you guys posted. He thanks you all for your fond best wishes and all the nice posts and comments that he's had regarding his contributions thus far on the pod. And Henry and I are obviously looking forward to having him back at a later stage. And with regards to what Henry said about the charity, I have a little bit of personal news to share with you, ladies and gents, in the sense of I had the shock of my life last Wednesday when I was in Leicester, went to an awards evening. I was up for an award, and the award came, it went, I didn't win it. And then there was this the special Numero Uno award, which wasn't nominated by anybody and wasn't a finalist. It was chosen by all of the, I would call it the big wigs, the senior entrepreneurs and business owners, and you name it, Chamber, Leicestershire Chamber people, all the rest of it. And they nominated me. Well, they nominated me. They awarded me the award of contributions to the community for the works that I've done in Leicestershire nationally for what is now possibly my 42nd year. And I don't look old enough. Thank you very much. But yeah, so I've got an award for contributions to charity in the community. So I want to thank everybody via this podcast that's helped myself, Henry, Pete, wheelie dealer before me, who's helped me raise monies for Memphis and lots of other charities. And this year we're obviously raising money for Centrepoint as well. I'll continue doing that. And the beauty of what I've done and we've done on this particular pod is that we've encouraged people to make a donation to various charities. We've also seen other people on other podcasts and other shows now looking to raise money and helping to raise money for charities. So it's all good. We're doing some good works here, and we hope to influence and encourage other people to show some kindness, volunteer in your communities, and help raise money locally. So the little projects that you know that are at grassroots level are desperate for it, otherwise they're going to go out of business. So I just want to thank everyone for their kindness that they've shown me regarding raising money, Henry and Weedy Dealer before that. And that's all for me. Anything you want to add to that, Henry?
Other than very well done and very well deserved.
Yeah. Thank you, kind sir. I want to give a massive shout out now, please, for our vulnerable Pete. This is outside my comfort zone. Guest, he's come on here. He's smashed it. He's brought all the data. He knows his onions. He does his research. He won't buy anything until he's, you know, had it by its throat and, you know, challenged it to every single question. Martin Flitton, you've been absolutely superb, sir. Thank you ever so much for being on this pod with Henry and I. If you haven't done so already, please, please, please follow Martin on Twitter/X @private_punter. And Martin's going to tell you where to find his blog in a minute. But please, please, please go and follow him and keep up with his research, because he's a phenomenal investor and researcher and writer/blogger. And also, he's a good egg. That's not just the shape of his head. He's a really good individual, good person. Martin, tell us where your blog's at, mate, please.
Yeah, cheers for that, Pete. And I've enjoyed this, although very nervous, as you know. So I'm a nervous sort of person, but there we go. So my blog. So what I try and do is I write predominantly about stocks that I've got an interest in, but not always. If I get the opportunity to speak with the company, I'll either bat it away because it's not something that I'm really into. So it's got to be right for me to put the story out there. And I try and get into stuff that maybe other people don't touch on, to get the sort of mechanics of the business, sort of like what we chatted about earlier. I appreciate people, dropping in, having a look at what I do. And as I say, it's a labor of love, but, I enjoy doing it. And if it helps other people, then that's what it's all about.
Brilliant. Where can we find it, Martin?
Oh, sorry. Well, it's on Twitter. And I guess if you Google it, you'll find it. But as you'll know, I'm not very good on that sort of stuff.
Let me try and find it myself here. I thought you were just going to tell me where to find it, but bear with me, sir. I always put people in spots, so apologies. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No, it's all right. It's no problem.
Let me just find it for you, and then people can...
If you it's available at... Here we go. Martin
right,
Flitton...
Okay. Go for it, Henry. Go for it.
martinflitton1.wixsite.com. That's martinflitton1.wixsite.com.
/private punter. Yeah.
And basically, if you just Google Martin Flitton blog, it will pop straight up. And I recommend going and scouring it and reading it and subscribing to it, because it's a very, very good site.
Cheers for that.
Bravo. Well done. Ladies and gents, this is the longest podcast we've done for a little while, but it's all been worth it because we've got so much fantastic insights and stocks. Not only from Henry this time, but also fantastically from Martin Flitton. Please follow him on Twitter, X and his blog. That's it from us. It's the 25th of June. Please, 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 if you've got the opportunity to go out and vote on July 4th. And regardless of the rhetoric, think about who is going to follow through with action, which is going to be meaningful for you, your family, the community, for the next 3 to 4 years, and not the individuals that are just doing the noise and, to use the word of everyone that's across social media, grifting. Okay, that's it. That's the end of podcast 130. Thank you, everybody, from wherever you are in the world. Take care. God bless you. Bye-bye for now.
This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with Sharepad from Sharescope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit sharescope.co.uk and discover the advantage.